Hello and a very warm welcome to Bruegel's podcast, The Sound of Economics. My name is Gunther Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and I'm very honored and pleased today to be joined by Ludger Schuhknecht, an eminent scholar and former government official who is currently visiting professor at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy in Singapore, and previously he was Deputy Secretary General at the OECD, as well as Chief Economist in the German Finance Ministry during, I would say, a turbulent decade in Germany and in the European Union. Hello, Ludger. Nice to see you and hear you.
Hello, Guntram. It's a great pleasure for me to be here on the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Ludger. So you have published very recently a book with Cambridge University Press called Public Spending and the Role of the State, History, Performance, Risk and Remedies. And now you have you're following up with further research, and you have a recent paper or presentation called Public Expenditure and the Post-COVID Challenges for Government. Now, Let's start with the beginning, meaning a look back at how governments have evolved, and that's how you start your book also, how governments have evolved, how government spending has evolved over the centuries, and you look in particular at public spending. And so I would be interested in first hearing from you sort of your look at the past. And then later on, we want to focus, of course, on the challenges that the post-pandemic era poses for governments, because government sectors have increased quite substantially. The role of the state has increased. This is welcomed by some people, but I think you are among those that are worried that actually public spending might go in the wrong direction. But let's talk about the future in a minute. Let's start from the past. Ludger, where are we currently and how did we get there?
Yeah, thank you, Guntram. Indeed, I think it is always good to start a bit with history. And when you look at the role of government and government spending in advanced countries, in today's advanced countries, say 150 years ago, 120 years ago, before World War I, the role of the state was much more limited, and governments only spent about 10% of GDP on defense, debt service, a bit of infrastructure, and public administration. And this changed and evolved quite a bit over time. Public education systems were set up, social security administrations evolved, as governments took on a more prominent role in providing core public goods and services. And by the 1960s, this role had actually evolved quite a bit, and people were quite happy, if one looks at it in retrospect, with the kind of services governments provided and the social security situation that was there. But they did that with 30% of GDP of public spending, which was significantly more than 100 years ago, but less than today. Today, we are, before COVID, we were at almost at over 30% of GDP of public spending. And this increase was almost exclusively on social spending.
And with COVID, so from 30, just to get the numbers again, so from 30 in the 60s and 70s to 40, basically an increase in social security spending.
That's right. That's right. The increase between 1960, it was actually on average about 28. And 2019 with 43, 44 in these countries that I looked at, is almost all of it is social security, a bit of a decline in investment and a bit of an increase in bureaucracy.
Well, but I think now, if I can sort of challenge you on that one, I mean, wouldn't this be what voters wanted? I mean, in democracies, they voted for more social security spending, didn't they?
Yes and no. And I mean, I think there are many factors that played a role. I mean, first of all, of course, population aging started. It's the big effect of population aging is still to come, but it started. But then, of course, as the economies became richer, there was some increase from that, and health systems, technologies developed. But on the whole, I think there's also kind of a legacy issue, because you know, you always add on top. You never really do a check on whether the additional spending helps to achieve the objectives in a better manner. And this is part of the problem, to my mind, today. We have a huge difference in the size of government. I mean, the average is over 40, but you have a range from around 30 in Ireland and Switzerland to over 50 in some smaller European countries and France. And the question is, you know, what do you get for the additional spending? And there are big differences, and often the citizens don't get very much.
So, in your presentation, Lutka, you have a very striking chart in which you talk about trust in government and the correlation between trust in government and public spending and the performance of core tasks. And if I understand you correctly, you really emphasize that it's not the social spending that gives trust in government. It is the performance. And the performance and the rule of law and the quality of the government that really correlates with trust in the government. Can you walk us through this chart and the sort of the main argument there?
That's right. I mean, the argument, first of all, it's just simply an empirical observation for Europe. When you correlate public expenditure with a trust in the citizens' own government, as you know, people have indicated in Eurobarometer, you see basically no correlation, not for total spending, not for social spending, a little bit on education. But when you look at the government performance, then you see a huge correlation, for instance, between the rule of law indicator, the international ones that are available, or also the public debt indicator, but also some of these other performance indicators like income distribution, like infrastructure quality, like education quality. So it's this this correlation between trust and performance, I think, that is really key, and which I think also is the bridge in a way between the question of how much spending and what kind of spending we should have. The message is, in a way, we should have spending that is effective in producing what government should produce, and that builds trust. It is, spending is not la pour la.
Right. But of course, we don't know whether more spending drives down the quality of government and the rule of law, or whether it increases the rule of law and the quality of government. Is there any sort of, do we know something on what determines sort of the quality of government, the government sector? I mean, this is it seems to me the key question, right? I mean, of course, we don't want wasteful states. We want states that operate efficiently, that are free of corruption, that do the things the best way without wasting money. But that doesn't. I mean, how do we link this to the size of the government sector?
Yeah, the literature, so to speak, on government performance and efficiency is really not yet very developed. And there are strong indications that it's really the governance, the institutions, that matter for the performance of governments, how well they spend their money. Countries with strong institutions tend to spend better. And then also a big government doesn't have too harmful effects on the performance of the economy. The Nordic countries are an example for that. But the analysis, the literature also shows that rather small governments, in Singapore, which is really one of the smallest governments of advanced countries, but then if closer to home, you look at Ireland, Spain, or very far away, Australia, you know, these are countries with very strong governance, strong institutions, and there the money is quite well spent, even to the extent that, you know, the combination of relatively small safety nets but good labor market policies produces quite good income distribution indicators, even when governments are small. So it is rather than kind of asking for more spending, I think the question, you know, if you want to improve the quality and performance of governments, is then, you know, you need better spending. And that, to my mind, is really closely linked to the institutional framework. But institutions in the broader sense, not just, you know, rules about deficit and debt, but really in a much broader sense.
So before we talk about the rules and deficits and debts and these dimensions, I would love to get a bit more on the more recent history from you, meaning there was two big shocks really in Europe in the last, 12, 13 years. So one, it was the global financial crisis followed by the European debt crisis and the Eurozone crisis, and then, of course, COVID. And so how has the government sector in that period performed, and what's your sort of more recent history assessment?
Yeah, I think there are two really important themes. One is, in a way, an underlying structural theme, and that is really the continuous rise in social spending that is now meeting population aging. And that has continued throughout all crises, independent of what has happened around. And we know that this is going to continue. We're going to have this population aging, and we need to deal with it. And all projections are that it will lead to further increases in public spending on top of the huge increases we've had over the past decades. And the second one is, of course, this recognition that we have a much stronger interaction between public finances and financial markets and financial developments than most of us had anticipated in the past, to the point, you know, that in a way, financial sector problems and high debt, or not even, in some cases, not even high debt, if you look at Ireland and Spain, this interaction can be so massive that it raises debt hugely and gets countries from financial to fiscal crisis.
Right, and so now let's talk for a few minutes about the future and how you see the projections of the size of the government sector. Of course, in the pandemic, governments all across the world, especially in the advanced economies, they massively intervened in the economy. They supported companies, they supported households, and I think you probably would agree they did so because they had to. There were public health measures ordered on companies, on the private sector, preventing them from doing a business, and the government in a sense stepped in to prevent massive company closures, massive insolvencies for firms that really, some of them were viable pre-pandemic, and, you know, basically had to close because of public health measures. So the government clearly played a very important role in this pandemic, and it increased the size of the government sector in absolute terms, but relative to GDP even more, because GDP collapsed quite substantially last year and is now, of course, recovering. And so just to get your sense of, are we going back to basically where we were pre-COVID as we gradually exit from the pandemic and from the public health measures? Or do you see that there's sort of a permanent trend to sort of do certain things now with the state sector involved? And I guess the answer is not a uniform answer, and there will be differences across countries, and we should perhaps also talk about that. But what's the trend that you see?
I mean, this is, of course, a key question, because ultimately the question is, are public finances sustainable? Are public finances going to be sustainable with the higher debt ratios that we have, with the risks from population aging and possible future financial crisis, and the higher level of spending that we now have post-COVID? And I mean, let me start by saying that I fully agree with you that these measures during the crisis were absolutely necessary. And I'm actually reasonably positively surprised by the quality of the measures. Sure, I mean, in some countries, special interests snuck in a few measures here and there that perhaps would not have been possible or necessary. But on the whole, I think it is, we can actually be quite proud on how governments dealt with the situation. But as always, to my mind, the exit from an abnormal situation to a normalization is perhaps the most difficult thing to manage. And one issue is, of course, the timing, where you have very different views. Some people saying, look, let's not start with this process before the economy is really back to full employment. And that is likely to be only much later. And you have others who say, no, let's start early because the economic rebound is going to be faster than most people predict, because the savings overhang is going to unwind more strongly. And plus a lot of stimulus on top of that will cause overheating. And then you have structural issues that could come in as well, in the sense that, you know, the higher spending may lead people actually to work less if the benefits are very generous, and it may kind of get people comfortable with a high spending. And then, you know, you have all kinds of special interests and ministries making demands on how this additional money could be spent in the future. So I think here the timing is important, but I would say let's not be too late, because, you know, then you might in retrospect say, well, we have missed an opportunity to bring spending back. The recovery itself will take care of some of the spending increase, because you mentioned the effect of, you know, the growth collapse that will hopefully mostly reverse. Still, there is a risk that spending ratios will stay higher depending a bit on the growth trend post-COVID. And so I think what many people, I think we all economists agree that a key challenge will be to get growth up. And then the question is, how do you do that? More with demand or supply measures, with more or less government spending and intervention? I probably would belong to the camp that is a bit more cautious on the demand side and would wish to have see more courage on the supply side.
Well, I guess not only probably you're for sure in that camp, I would say. But Lutka, let's perhaps talk a minute about the U.S. And then I also want to talk about a few European countries just to get your perspective on those also. But I think the U.S. is really quite a striking example at the moment, because, of course, the deficit has gone up enormously. The U.S. president even proudly says that this is the right thing to do now, because it will allow the U.S. to invest. And he has a very broad definition of investment, to invest into the future. And that is necessary in order to be able to compete with China. And he says it in so many words. And his chief economic advisor, Brian Deese, I mean, he makes that argument very explicitly, that this is also a result of the competition. And if you look at, let's say, indicators of the infrastructure in the United States, I mean, there has been considerable backlog, and the infrastructure hasn't developed really great pre-Biden, and arguably there's a lack of public infrastructure, including trains and so on and so forth. So there is a real argument here that we live in a different era. Public finance is can be cheaply funded. Deficits can be cheaply funded. Interest rates are very low. And the return on this investment is very high. What would you say, how would you react to this policy and this statement?
Well, I think there is two dimensions. There's, again, the short-term dimension and the long-term dimension. I mean, from the finding of my book, I would say it really depends on the governance. It depends less on the amount of spending, whether, you know, the infrastructure in the US or in many European countries can improve, you know, it's really often not a lack of money, but it's poor processes, lengthy processes, poor governance that holds that infrastructure development back. And there is massive amounts of private money that would be happy to come in if only, so to speak, the projects were progressing. And we have by now pretty good instrumentariums, good toolkits to also involve the private sector. So if the US says we want to do it with public money, fine. I personally think, why not get the management capacity, the financing skills from the private sector in. But the key is really the governance, that we create leaner processes, better processes, that the investment actually takes place and the money is not just thrown out of the window for white elephants or consumption. So this assumption of strong growth effects is contingent to my opinion. Now, the question whether cheap debt should be a motive for this, I'm not sure. I mean, we have lots of ineffective spending which could be cut and where the return is negative, so that cutting that spending is even producing a greater contribution than by financing higher investment through debt. But in that geopolitical considerations that the Americans are alluding to, I think the geopolitical consideration is important. Our countries need to be strong and have a good infrastructure for that. But we should also look at the long-term sustainability of our public finances, taking into account that when you have a lot of debt, you cannot simply overnight reduce that if, say, the financing environment changes. It's a long process. Germany took 10 years to bring debt down from 80 to 60%. So I think it is always good to keep in mind that overall budget constraint of a government in a medium to long-term context, and not relying on the fact that zero interest rates will prevail forever. So, geopolitically, I think we all know that a country is only as strong as its finances and its economies.
Hmm.
Well, I mean, let me sort of push you a bit further on the debt sustainability issue and the recent controversy is still again in the US, where I think, funnily enough, you will side with Olivier Blanchard and Larry Summers, who have been arguing that the additional stimulus in the US has been actually too big and risks being funded in part by higher inflation, and that this counteracting these inflationary pressures might actually lead to a new recession. So has the US deficit funded stimulus been just too big, but somewhat smaller would have been appropriate? Or how do you see this controversy that Blanchard and Summers actually created in the US?
No, I find myself in full agreement with Blanchard and Summers, and it's I think their argumentation is right from the demand side, and that, you know, if then central banks countervail that with higher interest rates, this could have adverse effects not only in the US but also in emerging economies. I would point to another long-term challenge here, that because of these risks of instability, there would be pressure on the central bank, on the Fed, not to raise rates, and so they'll be a bit between Scylla and Charybdis, in the sense, on the rock and the hard place, as I think the Americans say, as in the sense that if inflation rises and they raise rates, they cause problems, and if they don't raise rates, they also could cause problems. And then, as I said, I also see the structural issues, because if so to speak, we create this overheating environment, we further stoke the asset prices, and we might get into a boom bust cycle there. And it's to my mind, it's not clear that we will really get the higher growth impact from simply more stimulus and bigger spending programs without focusing on the governance issues. And that takes time, and it takes, in a way, it's good that the discussion is there, but I miss a bit the structural dimension.
Right, and let's move now to Europe, and I think there's so many dimensions in Europe that we could discuss, but of course, I guess starting again more from the structural side and then moving more to the demand and macro questions. But on the structural side, you mentioned quite a bit the pension system sustainability issues. And there is, of course, a very active debate on how to ensure that the pension systems remain sustainable by, for example, by increasing retirement age, which in a sense is the natural response to aging societies. It is to work longer and until we are all a little bit older than before we thought we would be when we would retire. Now, this is very controversial politically. In France, there's a very active debate now on whether the pension age can increase from 62 to 64. In Italy, actually, the pension reform under Mario Monti actually restored the sustainability of the pension system. But of course, it wasn't very popular, and Mario Monti wasn't very popular because of that also. And in Germany, I would say there is, in principle, there is a factor that should ensure that the pension payments do not increase more than the aging progresses. So there is a counter this age factor. I don't know how it's called in English now, but there is a factor that in principle wants to ensure the pension system sustainability. So are we not doing enough in that space? Is this debate, in a sense, if that is taken care of, how worried do we need to be really about the sustainability of the long-term sustainability of the public finances?
And the public spending on social security, in a way, politically really dominates. And there is evidence that higher social spending has actually contributed to driving out some of the more productive spending, like on investment. It's just simply very unpopular. And you mentioned, I mean, Mario Monti was able to do that in a crisis in Italy and Germany. It was the Schröder government when Germany was really in crisis. So pension reform typically takes place in crisis. Health spending is similar. And therefore, I don't really see any great chance for major social security reforms in the current environment, especially since with COVID, many people now ask for even more health spending and see this as a priority rather than saying, okay, we need to make the health sector perform better and focus perhaps more on these preventive issues like pandemics. And the risk is that, so to speak, this will lead to even more spending, and then the money, you know how it is, does not necessarily go to where the gaps lie, or at least not all of it. So I'm a bit skeptical for the near term on our ability, political ability, to tackle the aging challenges. We know we have to do it for the long run, but when in the short run everybody says there should be more social spending and debt is free, interest rates are zero, and so you get into a kind of a defensive framework which is I think not very conducive to get substantial improvements. At the same time, I think it's good that in our economies the debate continues, so that because you need to educate the population. You sometimes it takes really a long time. There are also some studies that show that it takes a long time to educate people. And then when a window of opportunity arises and the framework is right, that then it can actually happen. I don't think there will be big things in the next German coalition budget and coalition agreement, but I think the readiness and the acuteness of this to discuss this and to move in this direction will rise over time.
And turning to the macro picture, the European macro picture, the deficits are of course much smaller than those in the US. And I think people like Olivier Blanchard, probably in disagreement with you, I think are now suggesting that the fiscal rules could be changed, and that sustainability is less of an issue because of low interest rates and the famous R minus G, so meaning the real interest rate being lower than the real growth rate, meaning that actually sustainability is significantly better than we previously thought. And so he has been in an influential paper, he's been suggesting that in fact the rules could be adopted, the fiscal rules in Europe could be adopted and changed so that debt sustainability considerations are reassessed, and we move away from numerical fiscal targets towards a much more debt sustainability assessment based on basically projections of the interest rate and the growth rate, which looks much more favorable, even for countries with pretty high debt levels. So he seems to be much less worried than you are about deficits and debt, and the macro picture emerging is one where basically there's scope for more spending to be funded by deficits, and there aren't really big inflationary risks. So what would you reply to his view on the European Union?
I would say that he's really, I don't know, it's to me, it's not the real issue. I mean, mechanically, this debate about R and G, so it's a weird definition of sustainability. I mean, take Japan. It's now a debt of 260% of GDP, and R is smaller than G. Growth is about 1%. Interest rates are 0%. The average deficit of the past 25 years has been 6%. Now, if you put that into the computer and churn it a bit and simulate, you get no explosion in debt. So is that sustainable? Well, debt will rapidly increase above 300% of GDP, then to 400%, and then to 500% of GDP with these coordinates. But that is not sustainable. So we have here a mechanistic definition of sustainable that I think is not very relevant for so to speak the real world economy and politics that we are in, where you had a situation with Spain where the markets questioned the country's sustainability when debt was at 50 or 60% of GDP because they had big liabilities in the financial sector. And so this R minus G is an interesting concept, but we shouldn't overrate it. The second is the political economy. I don't think that governments and government budgets can be steered and fine-tuned so easily, and public spending cannot be fine-tuned so easily as kind of this approach would suggest. If you say, if you raise social spending, it's very difficult to bring that down. And even if you do, it takes typically time for all the measures to take effects. And if you find yourself with an unsustainable or high debt situation that markets suddenly throw out on, You know, you don't want to be in a situation where you suddenly have to do the step full blast onto the brake, like some emerging and developing countries had to do in the past, and some European countries in 2010-11. So I think it's a more prudent approach if you keep some safety margin and accept that governments cannot, you know, change their policies to the tune of economies that suddenly find that the situation has changed and now countries should be more prudent. It's also the, you know, the time consistency of policies, and that's where rules come in, where rules can help constrain governments from doing things, especially in good times. And you could argue that post-COVID, we will be in good times. Interest rates low, growth good, you know, the output gap will close quickly, employment will rise. I expect good times. And often mistakes are made in the good times because you pile on top of a good economy in expansionary fiscal policy. And then you have to deal with that when things turn around, and that is very difficult. So to my mind, fiscal rules are there, especially for good times. Whether you have them as expenditure, deficit, or debt targets, there's a lot, there are good arguments for either of them. But the key is that they are actually implemented. And here is another disagreement, if I understood Blanchard correctly in with co-authors, that they think it should be more like a guidepost or something, not something binding, but maybe I misread that a bit. So I think it becomes binding for governments. It affects their behavior if it is in fact implemented. Despite some of these different views on the macro outlook and, you know, the ability to fine-tune our economies, I think there's all of us have a lot in common. We know that we have to get this post-pandemic period right. And I think we could all also agree that it should be through high-quality government spending. So, I mean, all economists, all of us agree on that.
All right. I think, Ludger, we could continue, of course, for another hour, but I think the topic deserves certainly more time. But I'm afraid in this podcast format, we do not have more time. And really, I want to thank you for putting forward your views, your strong warning. I know it's a contrarian view to what many believe is the right approach now to public finance. But I think it really deserves this discussion because, you know, if some of the more mainstream views on this prevail and they get it wrong, then, of course, significant trouble is ahead. So it's important to have that debate. And I want to thank you really sincerely for presenting your book, your recent papers, and for being on this podcast with us today. It was really a great discussion. Thank you very much, Ludger.
Thank you, Guntram.
And if you have enjoyed this podcast, please do not hesitate to go on our App Store and download more podcasts, or go on our website, www.bruegel.org. To listen to more episodes or to download our research on this and many other topics. Thanks for joining to our listeners. Bye-bye.